When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 119. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am delighted to be finally heading down to Colchester in Essex to talk to arable farmer and National Farmers Union Crops Board Chairman, Tom Bradshaw. Tom, how are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks, Will. Cracking evening down here.
Yeah, it's lovely to see a bit of sunshine, isn't it? But you are more happy to see some rain, you were saying.
Yeah, we were very lucky to have 5 mil of rain today, and at the moment that 5 mil is probably worth, like it's worth an inch, really. So we're pretty desperate, but we can't change that, so we have to get on with it.
Absolutely. And you're also saying you've got the baby monitor right in front of you because you've got a new baby in the house.
Yes, we've got a 13-week-old, and my wife is out with her horses this evening, so we try and share responsibilities as much as possible. Uh-huh. And with me being away a fair bit with the NFU, it means that when I'm here, I just get given the monitor and told to get on with
things. I'm sure you do. Well, we'll excuse any interruptions tonight. But that's your second child, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we've got Pippa, say 13 weeks old, and then we've got Harry, who was 2 last week. So we've been very lucky, and Harry was just a sort of an angel child, really. And so when we had Pippa, and she wasn't quite as compliant as Harry had been, and we didn't quite know what to make of it, but it's been a little bit more of a challenge, but she's doing pretty well now.
Good. And how did you and Emily meet?
We were completely set up, Will. So I went to White College, Emily went to Harper Adams, so there's a good old rivalry there right in the middle of our relationship. But she was on a gap year, or placement year, I think they call it, but I think it was just a holiday. But and so she was working down in Newmarket for the second part of her placement, and some of my great friends from university were working there, so I'd finished at that point, and I rang this friend up and asked her if her and her boyfriend would like to come to Young Farmers Ball. And she said yes, but I'm bringing somebody else with me, and that certain somebody was Emily. So she walked around the corner at, I suppose, about 6:30 on a Friday evening, back in October 2004, and the rest is history.
So you were down in Essex, as I said in the introduction, but that's not where the family are from originally.
No. So we've, if we go back, my mum's parents were from Yorkshire, mm-hmm. and my father's parents were from Lancashire, or grandparents were from Lancashire, mm-hmm. actually. So we've got a white and a red rose mix there as well, but So they came down, my grandparents came down in the 1930s down to Essex, uh-huh. As a lot of northern farming families did. Sure. I mean, either from that region or, I mean, there's a lot of Scots farm in this area. Yeah. They all moved down. The land down here was cheap in the 30s. And I guess the grass looked greener, so they decided to move things down this way.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a bit about the home farm there.
So it's a very small family farm here, Will, 62-hectare family farm. Used to be a traditional sort of mixed farming business. Here on the home farm, there was cows, pigs, sheep, and a bit of arable. Mm-hmm. But now it's focused on, we've got a large equestrian diversification here on the home farm, and a bit of arable. And then we do a lot of contract farming sort of within 20 miles of home. So. And we're managing, I suppose, about another 1,200 hectares for 6 different landowners, and sort of specialising in arable production.
Wow. Okay. So it's changed a lot over the years then, since your grandfather and your father's time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you look back at the mid-90s, I mean, the farm here was supporting my grandparents, my father, and sort of us as a family, my dad's brother and their family. And even Dad's other brother was working on the farm. So, you know, they were feeding four families, if you like, off, I mean, I think it was 200 acres back then, so it's slightly larger. Mm-hmm. And it's quite incredible the way things have changed sort of in that since that period of time. But the mid-90s was in right at the high of a commodity cycle, and Dad and his brother decided they were going to split the farm at that point in time. So Dad borrowed a rack of cash and bought his brother out of the business.
Yeah, okay. So tell us about the pigs then. I presume you grew up sort of feeding the pigs and helping out with all that.
Yeah, so I've got two brothers. Well, and so I've got an older brother and a younger brother. And I guess when we were at school, to earn our pocket money, we had to go and, you know, we didn't have to. We were never forced to do anything, but we wanted our pocket money and we loved the farm. Mm. So there was an easy way to go and earn pocket money. And my older brother really did the cows. So he'd do the relief milking at a weekend, and then I did look after the pigs. And so, yeah, over weekend, I mean, the pigmen used to have one weekend off, and I'd do the other. Yeah, so we just do our turn on weekends. And so that's sort of how I grew up doing my pocket money. But I've always been mad keen on my sport. So it was always early morning starts, get the pigs done so I could get off and play cricket or rugby or hockey or something else. But
So in the early 2000s, you had an outbreak of swine fever, though.
Yeah, we did. So, I mean, in the mid-90s, when Dad brought his brother out, we had a breeding herd. I mean, we'd actually, if you go back to 1992, we'd had a really serious farm fire here. Right. I mean, at the time, it was very serious. But as we look back now, it gave us a great opportunity to sort of restructure the farm. And I think that's something you have to try and, you know, at that moment in time, it's very difficult. Yeah. But when you look back, there was a positive that came out of it. But the breeding herd went outside at that point in time. So in 92, we went to outdoor breeding sales.
Wow, okay.
And finishing inside. Mm-hmm. And then in 95, when Dad brought his brother out on, was it 97? 97, maybe. We then decided, or Dad decided, there was too much risk in needed a bit of security. And we started fattening pigs at BQP. And so we had bed and breakfast pigs taken through to bacon weight. And then, unfortunately, in 2000, we had the dreaded swine fever. So I think there was about half a dozen farms went down with swine fever. Mm. And unfortunately, some of the weaners came in from what the farm that first went down, and so we had to have the 1,350 pigs there. They were just about, I suppose, they were getting very close to bacon weight, so it was, you know, you couldn't have been much worse, really. But unfortunately, we have 1,350 pigs were all had to be slaughtered to stop the spread of swine fever, which, I guess, yeah, thankfully it worked, and there wasn't a widespread outbreak. But, you know, I remember I'd said to Dad that our pigman had to have the day off because he was getting very close to retirement. Mm-hmm. And he'd been with us since he left school. He worked for us for 50 years. And I said to Dad, I said, look, you know, I think that we should just tell him he's got to have the day off because he doesn't want this as a last memory. And I remember just looking over the yard, and there was a brick wall, and just seeing him peering his head over the brick wall and to sort of see what was going on. And it was just awful. Yeah. You know, it was one of those things that you can never wish on anybody. But you see what's going on in China at the moment with the outbreak out there. And, you know, it does sort of hit home, and just, you know, we've got to make sure that our biosecurity here is as good as possible, because it's certainly not something that the, you know, UK herd could deal with at the moment.
No, absolutely. So you've gone from, as you said, being sort of quite traditional farming, the pigs and sheep and the dairy herd on the farm, to being all arable now. Is that something that's been quite common in that part of the world, those kind of changes?
Yeah, I mean, no doubt we'll get onto my Nuffield scholarship later on, Will, but one of the things I was looking at on my Nuffield is sort of how we could try and recreate the fertility from the livestock unit, because a lot of the land we'd started contract farming didn't have the history of livestock. But as we look, as you look around East Anglia, I mean, traditionally there were always mixed farms. You know, I can look around here and you could easily find a dozen dairy herds within 5 miles of here, and now there's not one.
Yeah.
Essex, I think, now has got 6 or 7 dairy herds left. It's the change that's happened. I mean, a lot of outdoor pigs, if you get up into Norfolk in particular, but Suffolk and Norfolk, you know, some of the soil there is really suited to outdoor pigs. There's a big outdoor pig herd up there. But other than that, you know, really, the amount of livestock is very limited. And I think that the arable businesses are probably now paying for that. in terms of the lack of fertility sort of going forward.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weigh bridges, portable weigh beams, multi-axle weigh bridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weigh beams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks, and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software, and one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products. They'll be displaying a set of portable weigh beams for demonstration at the upcoming Cereals event in June, and if you're planning on going, head down to stand 966 for a chat to one of their specialists. Well, yeah, we're hearing a lot of discussion about that now, aren't we? Of course, in many arable areas, we're seeing the return of livestock again after many years with increasing focus on soil health.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one. I try and be very clear, and to my mind, the livestock have got to make money themselves. And
yeah.
As we look at the dreaded Brexit, the biggest challenge, I don't know if that's quite right, but certainly, yeah, the red meat sector is under a huge huge threat if we go off a cliff and have a no deal. And but I look at the opportunities around East Anglia, and if there wasn't the Brexit question mark, then if you're a young young body wanting to come into the industry, I think the opportunities in a sort of flying sheep flock, with very low capital requirements and not necessarily needing a lot of access to buildings, there's a lot of cover crops being grown and things like that. And I think that may be where the opportunities lie for the next generation who are desperately seeking to make it into farming.
Absolutely. Do you miss having stock on the farm? Personally,
one day of the year, and I sort of say that tongue in. Well, that's probably 2 days of the year.
Yeah,
I always say Christmas Day because actually it's a damn good reason to get up off your backside after eating far too much at the Christmas dinner table.
Yeah.
But the first day of turnout in the spring is just such a magical day.
Yeah,
when you see the cows skipping around the fields like they do, it is that's the day. You see videos online of people turning their cows out, and that's the one sight sort of scene that I really miss. Because it's something that brings a smile to your face, and I'll say never forget the turnout day. We'll forget plenty of electric fences that got run straight through and things like that. But.
Yeah. So how did you get started with the contract farming?
I've got an older brother, as I think I might have said earlier, and he was at Reading doing agricultural economics, but he'd taken a couple more years to do his A-levels than I had, so he was first year at Reading and I was first year at Y. I started there in 2000, and then that's spring an opportunity came up in the neighbouring village. So Dad was already managing a dairy herd in the neighbouring village on a sort of contract farming basis, and he was farming next door to this gentleman, Mr. Brown, and he'd heard that the farm was coming up for tender, a 400-acre farm, beautiful farm, one of the most productive, efficient farms that we've got, but also just, it's just got a lovely feel to it. And Dad rang him up and said, I've got three boys, what do you think, would you give me an opportunity to tender? Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, absolutely. So Stuart, my older brother, and I did the tender, we sent it to each other on Excel, and it was amazing how close the figures were. So we decided that we were going to put in this offer to farm the farm. We then took a bit of professional advice, and the consultant in question turned around and told us we must be absolutely nuts and there's no way we'd ever make it pay.
Is that right?
he did say it only sent us a bill if we were successful. I don't think he thought there was a hope telling us that we were going to be successful. Long story short, the Duncan Brown, who unfortunately passed away very recently, but back in 2001, 2002 was the first harvest there. Back in the early summer of 2001, had a short list of two families, both who got sort of sons coming home to the business or that could come home to the business. And I think he just, you know, he thought he was doing something to help another farming family on the, you know, run up the ladder. And we had an amazing relationship, Bunker and I. And it's something that we now hope is going to continue with his sort of the rest of his family. And so, yeah, it's set us up really well and gave us a sort of a leapfrog into the arable sector with this 400 acres. Which at the time we'd only got 80 acres of cereals, so it was a huge step up. But it was one of those opportunities. And yeah, the trouble was that I remember looking at those budgets, Will, and if I've learned anything, and it was a very harsh lesson very early on, is that spreadsheets can tell you absolutely anything.
Yeah, I suppose they don't factor for weather conditions, I guess.
They don't factor for weather conditions or world markets. Well, yeah. I think we budgeted on £95 a tonne and we ended up selling the first harvest at 58 or something like that. And we budgeted on 3.6 tonnes an acre and we got about 2.7. So, yeah, very rapidly the whole cash flow and everything was torn upside down. And it was a pretty steep learning curve. But thankfully, we lived through it to tell the tale.
Yeah, and you built up pretty quickly from there, didn't you? You grew rapidly over 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, we were just very lucky with the opportunities that came around. The neighbouring farm to us here was sold back in, it would have been 2002, I suppose, one or two. And it was a 500-acre farm, just had a brand new irrigation system put across it. Well, in the best of soil, but was owned by a pension company, and they decided they were going to get out. And anyway, the person who bought the farm, to this day, we still don't know who it is.
Oh, wow.
But it was bequeathed to the Woodland Trust, okay. Or given to Woodland on a 99-year sort of peppercorn rent.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we've now got about 350 acres of woodland, which has been planted next door to us. But when that farm was given to the Woodland Trust, we were asked to do all the work on the estate. So that was great because it was a monthly check coming in. Mm-hmm. So that did ease some of the cash flow challenges because it just, you sent them a bill and you got paid. So
yeah.
That worked pretty well. Whereas the contract farming, you're so reliant on the profit shares to really make everything work that often it's 18 months, even nearly 2 years before you've actually got your money in.
Mm.
So that was, yeah, right next door to us. And then I guess just different contacts, agronomists introduce you to people, or you know, land agents knew that Dad had got sons who were interested in the business, and we were asked to tender for a block of land. One in particular, I remember we still farm most of ever. There's only one farm that we've ever taken on that we don't farm any longer, and we just couldn't get to an agreement on sort of taking that forward. But the farm I'm thinking of now, there used to be the Farm Business Advice Service, and Dad didn't know any of the consultants on the list. When he looked at the list and he rang them up, he said, well, can I have this guy, Peter Bennett? And Peter works for Savills, still does now. And they sort of, his name wasn't on the list, but they sort of agreed to Dad having Peter Bennett out for this free consultation. And then I suppose 5 years later, a letter dropped through the door. A farmer that we'd never heard of was asking us to tender for this farm, sort of 10, 12 miles away. And it was all because of Peter Bennett. Mm. He'd seen the passion that Dad and that the boys had got, and he thought, well, look, you might be a good fit for this business. And that's 1,000 acres down there that we farm, which we took on in 2004. And we've got a great relationship with the family down there, and they've diversified into other things, and we've sort of managed the arable for them.
Mm. Which just absolutely highlights the importance of personal relationships, doesn't it?
The whole thing is about relationships, Will, you know, and it's, you probably underestimate that as a youngster.
Yeah.
Well, certainly, I guess I probably did, but, so much of it is about relationships. Mm. You know, the gentleman down there, the whole thing about our business is you have to be transparent, it's completely sort of watertight in everything you do. You just got to make sure that it's all based on trust.
Yeah.
And so everything is based on trust. And I always say to the guys that work for us, you know, we all make mistakes, but if we make a mistake, pick up the phone to me so that I can ring them and tell them there's a problem before they see it and ring me and say, what the hell has happened here? And, you just got to be upfront and whiter than white and try and sort of have that integrity running through the business.
Mm, absolutely. And so building up so quickly, a lot of big investments in machinery to make. You bought a lot of second-hand machinery, big American articulated tractors, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, uh, we I don't do as much of the tractor work anymore, Will, but you know, back then it was me and my father. My older brother had left the farm, he'd gone off to do accountancy, so it was me and my father, and then yeah, there was a couple of guys on the cows, and sort of probably four of us on the farm. But yeah, we worked some pretty crazy hours, but those old American Arctics put a hell of a smile on your face. So, again, I think it was autumn 2003 or summer 2003. It was an absolute record breaker. I think we got to 38 degrees here.
Wow.
I remember sitting in that Steiger Panther, green in colour, and it was like a greenhouse.
Oh,
but yeah, we had some fun times, and the farm that we used to farm over in Suffolk, it's got some fair hills on it, and a mate of mine came up from Cornwall, and he said, you know, these are even fair hills for Cornwall. Mm. And I remember there were times where all you could see was the bonnet of this big old American Arctic. You couldn't see this. You couldn't see anything other than that. And you were sort of trying to climb up these hills. They just load appreciation, mm. and you know, cheap to buy. Reasonably cheap to run, although in the end that's probably what got the better of us. It was just we needed to be able to budget on our repairs bill. They were an absolute pain in the backside to move around, all on dual wheels. You had to have escorts for everything. Oh, yeah. We're doing a lot of road work because we're quite spread out. But that added another dynamic to it all. Mm. But it was great fun, and we just, you know, I guess I just absolutely loved the. Doing it all, mm-hmm. and working any hours that God gave at that point, and it was great fun. But I guess at some point, it's great building a business on that ethos, but you can't expect everyone to work all those hours, and it's not sustainable to do that long term.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you've changed and grown the business so much over the years. Is there anything that you do differently at all with hindsight?
I always thought, well, when I came back to the farm, that I probably wasn't ready to come home to the farm, but there was an opportunity here. Yeah. And Dad was either going to be employing somebody to take on the arable, or basically, my older brother always knew he wanted to do accountancy, so I was sort of next in line. And I'd finished Y. I'd been out in New Zealand and I had 6 months down there, learning the ropes and having a ball. It was great fun. And then there was this opportunity, and I sort of, well, I guess I decided before I went to New Zealand, but my older brother held the fort here for a year, and I went off down there, and then I came back in April and took on the job. But at that point, I always felt a little bit exposed, mm. in that I hadn't done the management training programs. Yeah. You know, I think these Velcro or Sentry or some of the MDS management training programs are fantastic, mm-hmm. Grounding and something that, now, I always felt that I hadn't had when I came back to the farm. And, you know, I've been so lucky that not all father-son relationships work out like ours did, but Dad has given me so much opportunity. Mm. And I'd been home 3 months, and I turned around to Dad, probably less than that actually, and said, look, Dad, I think we should sell the cows. And he turned around to me and said, show me the figures. Mm. And My older brother turned around and said, right, look, we can't do that. It's defeatist. People will think we're giving up. And I was like, look, Stu, this is not about other people. This is about what's right for the farm. Yeah. And, so I'd been home in April, and by August, the cows had been sold. And there's not many, many fathers I know of that would have sort of taken that step and put their trust in somebody who'd only been back in the business for such a short period of time. Mm. So I have been, I've been very lucky, but I guess that's where, I did feel slightly exposed about that. I didn't have the training, but I guess that's one of the reasons that I've done so much sort of personal development through the years since then, to try and make sure that I keep up to date. And I guess realizing really that the business is only as good as the management that I put into it.
So just going back a few years, I think you mentioned earlier you were a bit of a sportsman in your younger days.
I loved my sport, Will. I mean, I still do, but I just don't have time to play anymore. But I used to play rugby. I was lucky that in Colchester there's a fantastic grammar school, and somehow I managed to bluff my way through the 11 plus. I went to the grammar school, and at the time didn't really think much of it. But as I look back now, it gave me such a good education. It's very highly performing school, and but the sport was just fantastic. So I always sort of think I got the best of a private education without my parents having to spend a penny. So,
yeah,
I was really lucky. But yeah, I was playing rugby 6 days a week. At one point, I was playing for the school and for Colchester Rugby Club, and you know, captaining Colchester Rugby Club and school and stuff, and just absolutely loved it. And then yeah, as soon as the rugby season finished, I was into hockey and then into cricket, and played cricket all over the country. So. Wow. Yeah, it was just great time, and I still play. I mean, I played cricket probably until 2 or 3 years ago, but hopefully it's something that I might be able to pick up when Harry decides that he likes cricket. I might be able to do that with him.
Yeah, I noticed farmers on Twitter. So Russell McKenzie's got some cricket nets for one of his lads in his grain store, hasn't he? Always think that. So.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah,
great.
Idea. Yeah, I'm not sure what the old ACCS inspector is thinking of that.
Yeah, and you must have done pretty well in school, because they wanted you to apply for Cambridge.
Oh, these high flying schools are all it's about for them. It's Oxbridge, bloody, Oxbridge numbers is all they want.
Yeah.
And, they turned around at me and said, look, Tom, I think it was rural land management or something like that is the easiest course to get into at Cambridge. I mean, and so they tried to get me to go, but I ought to apply. But, I was enjoying my sport far too much. And, I knew that by then I'd met somebody, a mate who was going to White College, who was having a great time down there. I went and visited, and I just fell in love with the place.
Yeah.
So, you know, you went through this archway into one of the quads, and I just thought, I could see myself going to university there. So I basically switched off for my final year of A-levels and just played cricket. and so I got through all right, but Cambridge wasn't for me. But I guess I never knew about the Cambridge College as well, and I bought, or Oxford for that matter, and, you know, I've had dinner in a few of the Cambridge colleges now.
Yeah.
They are stunning places.
Yeah.
You know, they really are. And now, do I regret not going? No, because I've had so far so good. I've got on okay, but I do think, you know, it may have been different if I'd known what was around the corner, what existed over there.
Yeah, and were you one of those kids who was always going to come home to the farm? You're always going to be a farmer.
Mum and dad have never ever put any pressure on us to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if anything, I think that they, the reality is, well, a 62 hectare farm is not big enough for us to come home to.
Yeah.
And so we either had to, as I said, Dad's been a big supporter, but he's also been, I mean, and still is, he still works on the farm full time now, but through the early 2000s, and I know I've never known anyone as committed to work as Dad was.
Mm.
And so he's what enabled us to build the business on the arable side and keep everything ticking while, I was off at university and as Stuart was. But, I suppose I got the bug, and, there's just something about farming that, and you have to love it, as you will know. I guess everyone who's done this podcast would tell you that you can't teach it, but it's just something that gets in the blood. And, there's some pretty special days, and I don't drive the combine anymore, but there's nothing more satisfying than going into a crop of wheat and seeing 12 or 13 ton a hectare on the yield meter, and thinking, wow, we've really got this right this year. It doesn't happen very often.
No.
But they're some of the memories that and then to live in the countryside, for my family growing up now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a wonderful place to live, and you have so many opportunities that I certainly took for granted when I was a child, and it's nice to be able to give those things back to our family.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about the equestrian business you've got there.
Yeah, so bizarrely, we decided to sell the cows, and we thought we could set up an equestrian unit, and then
where did the idea for that first come from?
I think it was from that farm business advice service that Dad had. So we went out of pigs in 2000 when our pigman retired, and we'd had a range of buildings sat there empty since then.
Yeah.
But we never, Dad was flat out milking cows, and he didn't really have time to focus on what to do with those buildings.
Yeah.
But this in the farm business advice service, they sort of, one of the suggestions was, I think, you could think about a few stables. I think the trouble is that five stables isn't very compatible with a dairy herd, not unless it's a split site. And also, for the hassle you get from five stables, you've got to question whether it's really worth it. But once we'd made the decision to sell the cows, then we had a whole site that we were looking at, that effectively the whole thing could be converted over to anything. And I didn't want to look at housing or anything like that, because if we'd done that, that was a one-off income and it was done. Whereas that option would still be there at any point in time if the equestrian business didn't work. And then my mum saw an advert, and it's bizarre, but Colchester's a garrison town, and Colchester Garrison were moving to new barracks. And they'd always had a cavalry years ago, and after the cavalry, they ended up setting up a riding school. And the rumour has it that this colonel who was in charge back then was looking for his CBE. He went to the riding, it was a members club, so he went to the members and said, right, we're going to shut the riding school down. But he rapidly realised that with 120 irate women there in front of him, if he wanted to make a success and have his CBE, he was going to have to find another location for the riding school. So anyway, Mum had seen this advert, and I picked up the phone to them and I said, look, I hear you're looking for a new site. And they said, look, thank you very much, we'll take your details, but we've found someone. Mm. And so I took my details, and then literally the following day they rang back and they said, look, it's all fallen through. Are you serious about having us move, like, come over to you? Now, you've got to remember, at this time we hadn't got planning permission, we were still milking cows. And we said, yeah, absolutely. They said, well, when can we come out and look? And they probably came that afternoon. If not, it was the following day. And they walked into what was the lying area, because our cows were all loose housed, because straw here is not quite as valuable as in other parts of the world. So they're all loose housed. And they walked into what was the cow yard. And I said, oh, this is going to be an indoor school. And they looked at me and they said, you what? I said, oh, yeah, this will be an indoor school. And I think it's 24 by 36 metres or something like that. So it's not quite, you know, a proper size would be 20 by 40 metres. Yeah. But actually, in the riding school, it doesn't really matter, because they tend to be starting with those, the non-riders, rather than those that are training for a dressage event or anything like that. So they looked at that and they were like, well, you're nuts, but okay, this is the riding school. There's still a milking parlour in the corner of it as well, and obviously we were milking the cows. And then we walked into an old pig shed, and I said, this is where the stables are going to be. And again, it was just an empty pig barn. And I think they thought I was absolutely nuts. I guess this was the end of June or something like that. And they said, right, we've got a problem. So the original barracks was being sold for housing. And they said, we've got to be out by the 15th of August. And I said, no, look, we've got to get plan permission. There is not a chance that we can do anything by the 15th of August. So then they came back to me and said, look, the 15th of November, is it possible? And I just said, yep, we'll do it, the 15th of November. And they said, you sure? And I said, yep, we'll do it. And so I think the cows probably had been booked in to be sold by then. But that was, cows didn't go till mid-August. We hadn't got planning permission, so we had to put a planning application in, and brother and I decided that we were architects at that point, and we threw up everything, sort of pen and paper, and put the application in ourselves. And anyway, luckily the planners gave us everything we went for, and sure enough, the horses moved in on the 15th of November.
Wow. That must have been an intense few months. Jeez.
Well, I didn't leave the farm. So I said to Dad, Dad and I had to make a decision, and one of us was going to convert the yard and one of us was going to do the arable. And I think probably the most difficult time for Dad was when the cows were going.
Yeah.
A lot of people walk out to a farmyard that had always been a dairy farm, and you can tell it was a dairy farm even 10 years later.
Yeah.
Here, that never ever happened. You know, you walk, one day the cows had gone, the next day we were taking the milking parlour down and it was gone. And so 3 months after the cows had gone, you could never really tell there was a dairy herd here. And I think that for the mine, that was absolutely the best thing, because it's not like every day you went out there and thought about cows. Mm-hmm. So Dad actually went and Dad managed the arable side of the farm for that summer and autumn in particular. And I didn't leave here. I just, would get up and go outside at 5:30 and be out there converting, ripping things down and sort of getting things ready. And I remember one day Dad came back from drilling. I said, right, Dad, tomorrow I've got some concrete lorries coming at 9 in the morning. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, look, I've worked it back. If we don't get this wall in the end of the riding school, then we're not going to have time to get the riding school in by the time the horses move in. And he was like, all right, have you cut the steels down? And they were the steels off the old silage plant. I was like, no, they're still stood up. And so, again, one of those moments where I think he thought I was completely nuts. But we went out there the following morning, and we, sure enough, managed to concrete these RSJs into position. And, you know, how we did it, I don't know, but you'd be a brave man to say they're not straight now. So that's 15 years later. Yeah. But, so it was, I guess it was one of the beauty of finding a tenant, Will, was that we were suddenly in a position where they took a 15-year lease mm-hmm. out. They actually, you know, we didn't know this when we signed the tenancy, but we didn't sign the tenancy until probably a year after they'd been with us. And that is not something I'd ever advise anyone to do, because it did get pretty stressful at one point. But when they finally signed the tenancy, they then turned around to us and said, well, look, we've got this money in the, I think it was from the building company for getting out of the site. Can we pay you 5 years rent?
Oh, wow.
And that was just music to our ears. We were up to the nines.
Can we pay you 5 years rent as you snatch their hand off?
Yeah, at that point, you're trying not to smile, William. You're saying, you know, if you have to, then we'll accept it. But, it was a private business being run by Colchester Garrison. And it should never quite function like that, but it was a members club. But anyway, they were great tenants for 12 years. We always knew the rent was coming. You know, you never had to worry about that. It was self-funding, so it didn't cost the taxpayer anything. But it just, they were excellent tenants. Mm. But then 2 years ago now, my wife and I bought them, bought their business, because they'd finally got a colonel in charge who'd said, look, we shouldn't be doing this, and we're going to shut the riding school down. So they couldn't really select anybody else other than my wife and I, so we sort of got a good deal on it. But it's a really nice business to be running for Emily, to be running alongside having a young family. It works really well, because she's not committed to it 9 till 5, but it's it ticks over really nicely. It's great to see kids learning to ride, get out in the countryside. We've got grass tracked around all the fields here that they can use, and gets people out there and sort of engaged in the countryside. So it's lovely to see that. And then we've also got, so that the riding school takes 15 stables, and then we've got 68 stables here in total. So the remainder are just DIY livery or full livery, or basically if you've got a horse, we can look after it depending on what you want. There's nothing that they can't really do. So we've got some good girls, and one of them's been with us just over, coming out for 11 years now. So she runs the sort of delivery yard side of things, and it's worked really well.
Mm, fantastic. So you've done a lot of personal development over the years, like you mentioned earlier. You're obviously someone who does like to challenge themselves and keep improving with these things.
Yeah, I mean, I love farming, but I don't ever want to become isolated and stuck on the farm.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
It does, yeah.
I've always been intrigued as to what's going on, and you know, I've never just been happy with doing it the way we've always done it. And so I've always wanted to change things. You know, we've changed things a lot over the years. We started direct drilling in the sort of mid 2000s, and then we stopped because we had a couple of difficult few years. But I never really gave up on the direct drilling, and I wanted to understand how I could make it work better. And I don't think you can do that on farm. You know, you've got to get off and see other people and understand what's going on. So I did my basis and my facts, because we've got a great agronomy sector in this country, but I want to be involved in the decisions.
Of course.
I spend a lot of money on plant protection products every year, and I just feel that there's nobody better to be making those decisions or challenging those decisions than me, because we're paying the bills at the end of the day. I did my agronomy training, and then I did my fertilizer training sort of mid 2000s, and then 2011 I applied for an offer of scholarship. And I think that the truth there, Will, is that Emily wasn't really ready to have kids, and anything she could do to get me off farm was probably why it happened. And she was like, "No, yeah, you, I don't, I'll support you." And, I applied to do an Usher scholarship, and It's probably still the most daunting interview I've ever done, walking into the room. So, I mean, any of the listeners out there will. It is a massive opportunity. Yeah. And, you know, you can take it as far as you want to. And, you know, there's really no pressure once you've done it or when you're doing it. But it does give you an opportunity to go and travel the world and look at something you're passionate about. Mm. But, yeah, you're sat there, you walk into the interview room and you've got at least, I think there's six people on the other side of the room, but depending on which sponsors might be looking at you as a potential candidate, you could have 12 people on the other side of the table. Wow. And I guess I did enjoy it, but, yeah, you'll have heard me say I've been lucky several times, but this was another one of those situations where I was always advised in the run-up to the interview to be well read, because Nuffield's about passion. It's not about, yeah, you don't need to be a straight A candidate. Mm. It's about having a passion for agriculture, wanting to further yourself and the industry, and but also not letting Nuffield down, you know, so you're not bringing the name into disrepute, mm-hmm. as it were. So they're trying to find how you tackle difficult questions, and there's always something from that you completely unexpected. And the question I got asked, well, on the train on the way up there, I was reading the Times, and there was an article about Julian Assange, and I turned the page, ignoring it, because I thought, I'm not interested in that. And then I flicked the page back, and I thought, no, you must read it. And my question was, Julian Assange, hero or villain?
Okay.
And it was just one of those moments, yeah. You know, where I say it was sheer luck that I turned the page back and read about him. If not, I would not have had a clue who he was,
yeah.
Going into that interview. And there I was. There's no right or wrong answer to that question, but what they want to see is that you've got an opinion,
yeah.
and that you don't just dig yourself a hole.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's... but, yeah, thankfully, Nuffield decided that they would give me an opportunity, and I guess probably 3 weeks later I found myself out in New Zealand, because that's the timetable has changed a bit now, but when we did it, you had the interviews late January maybe, so it might have been 6 weeks. And then you had the Contemporary Scholars Conference, which is where all of that year's scholars from around the world, so there's about 50 around the world at any one year, I think, something around mm-hmm. that number. There's Australia, New Zealand, France, Holland, Brazil, and now trying to bring in the United States. There used to be Zimbabwe, but tragically that hasn't really mm-hmm. been functioning, although there is a Zimbabwean scholar this year, which is just brilliant.
Yeah.
That they might be able to get that back off the ground. But so they put these 50 guys or 50 people, I mean, yeah, very mixed group of people in the room, and sort of throw a few bombs in and ask you to get on with it. So, you know, you're debating GM and organics and all different sorts of things. And then they bring in inspirational speakers, and you're having late nights and early mornings. And it's just great fun, mm-hmm. Meeting all these different people from around the world. And you're rooming with people you've never met before. And it's a great icebreaker. But our Contemporary Scholars Conference was down in New Zealand just after the Christchurch. I'll turn that phone off, Will. I turned it on just so that I didn't miss your call, you see. So, it was just after the Christchurch earthquake. And, you know, we didn't know for quite a while whether we'd be going down there or not. And then, yeah, got the green light to go ahead. But we'd finished the Scholars Conference. We were on our way back to the airport. And we were taking on a sort of trip around Christchurch as close to the middle as we could get. And it was, again, one of those moments which will live with me for probably forever. Mm. You saw the cracks in the ground. Mm-hmm. We'd had one of the speakers, they said they bring in these inspirational speakers. One of them was a guy, I forget his name now, but he started the student army in Christchurch. And they went out sort of just helping people wherever they could, that well, not where there was medical emergencies or where there was danger, but there was all this I forget what they call it, but liquid sand had come up into the
a lot of houses, read about that places.
And they were just going and clearing houses and just doing anything they could. And that guy was absolutely unbelievable. He probably hardly slept for a fortnight or 3 weeks when we got there. Yeah. And he came and presented brilliantly, and then I think there was a guy called Mark Inglis, if I get the name right as well, but the name's not that important. But this chap had nearly lost his life up Mount Cook on a training expedition, and he then came and spoke to us about it's sort of not letting these things get you down. Mm-hmm. And since then he's won 2 Olympic medals, he's climbed Mount Everest, and you know, again, those things, I don't know how Nuffield decided to put these things together. And at the time, yeah, they're powerful speakers, but I think it's when I look back on it that you really realise how it changed my outlook on life.
Yeah.
You know, and just gave you, such a good grounding to sort of try and take things forward and, I guess, inside and outside our business, really, you know, as an industry. Some of the things we've got to think about.
Mm, yeah, I mean, as you'll know, I spoke to a lot of people who've done Nuffield scholarships on the podcast, and they do all say a similar thing, really. I mean, what did you get out of it in terms of your own business and the farming?
I applied to look at the future of UK arable farming. Mm-hmm. I guess my main concern really was soil fertility. Mm-hmm. So we narrowed it down in the end to soil fertility and fertilizer use efficiency, just because we saw the future of UK arable farming was too big a topic.
Yeah.
What did I take away from it? When I set off, I wanted to look at everything from organics through to GM so that I could come back with a view as to what I thought. Where I thought the sensible middle ground for our business was. Now, whether that was going to be organic or whether that was going to be, you know, the latest technology, I couldn't have told you when we left. But that was, you know, so I wanted to look at as broad a spectrum as I could. I met a lot of soil scientists. So I went to Australia, Argentina, USA, Germany. The USA, I went to the Acres USA conference, which is a sustainable farming conference. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the most difficult 4 days of the whole Nuffield experience, because I spent 4 days being challenged about everything we were doing in conventional agriculture and having to justify to myself, not publicly, but just to myself, why are we using fertilizer? Why are we using ag chem? Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? Now, I met with some great Amish guys who obviously were doing things really differently. Mm-hmm. So that moment in time was just a real challenge. Now, we still do a lot of what we did before, but having been through that thought process of why are we doing it? Why aren't we doing this? Why are we using that instead of that? And yeah, I think that was an incredibly powerful sort of thought process to go through. And then down in Argentina, there was a guy down there, Roberto Peretti, and he tells a story that he was sort of the father of no-till. And that he walked into his blacksmith probably 35 years ago now and said, I don't want to plow, I want to just drill. And they looked at him and sort of said, you must be mad. And he said, no, don't worry, there's four of us, so it's okay. And anyway, later on, you know, he's still direct drilling now. You know how many millions of hectares are direct drilled through South America. Mm. And you know, he's selling drills across the world. But we'd go through, he was in northern Cordoba, and we'd go through his patch. 480-acre square field, just absolutely stunning the way they've divided it up.
Yeah.
But we'd go through, and I'd say, that's one of yours, Roberto, isn't it? And he'd say, yeah. And then we'd drive along, and then I'd say, that's one of yours, Roberto, and he'd say, yeah. And his fields were just immaculate. Yeah. You know, his attention to detail, it was just absolutely out of this world. There, he was on a 45% clay soil, so you know, it's got a lot of clay in it. I think the biggest difference between there and here is that they get higher evapotranspiration rates, but you know, they're getting 1,200 mil of rain a year where he was. So it was, I guess he was proof to me that it can work. But to them, GM has been such an important part of why they've been able to sort of develop the systems they've developed. Mm.
You've done lots of business and leadership courses as well as what you gained from Nuffield. How much confidence do you think you've gained from all that? Because now, and we're going to talk about your role with National Farmers Union, you know, you obviously have to present to a lot of people, you have to have a very broad range of knowledge of different topics. All those different things must have helped, I guess.
Yeah, I think they've all played a different role at a different time, Will. And, I think back to Y College, and I would say I was never the most proficient presenter. I used to quite enjoy it, but I didn't ever feel that I was that good. Mm-hmm. Nuffield, I think the best thing about Nuffield is the broad spectrum of subjects that you get to cover. So you go to a Nuffield farming conference and you've got 18 different topics from the broadest spectrum of the agricultural industry you can imagine. And that is, gives you such an oversight of what's going on, in different sectors that otherwise I had no idea about. Mm. The Westfield Company of Farmers Management course, I think really sharpened up my business management. Mm-hmm. just made me focus on some of the key things that I think are the key influences in our business, and also set some business goals and some direction, which probably before I didn't have. So then maybe I used to wander a little bit, but now we have sort of a few more clear targets and more focus on running it like a business rather than, you know, a farm. And that's not to be disparaging to people who run farms, but you know, this has to be a business. When we're farming other people's land for them, we cannot afford to lose money farming other people's farms. And so we have to be, you know, pretty strict on that. The leadership course I did recently, or a couple of years ago, the Institute of Agricultural Leadership, Institute of Agricultural Management Leadership course, was a completely different topic. Now, when I went for that interview, I was really, really unsure whether I should be doing it or not. And I would say it was a two-way interview to work out what the course was going to give me, as well as whether I was suitable for the course or not, because I just worried that it was going to be the worst for the company of farmers course again. Yeah. But what did that do? I mean, I think it, at a time where I was beginning to get more involved with the NFU, it just gave me such a good grounding of European politics, the Brexit issues across all sectors. You know, we had somebody from Northern Ireland and from the Ulster Farmers Union there. And so, you know, okay, with, you know, a Kiwi there who'd gone through knew what it was like in the mid-80s down in New Zealand. And I think the broad analysis of how things were at that point in time and the challenges around Brexit was just a perfect timing for me just before I was lucky enough to take on the NFU role. So I think that was, you have to present these things, you have to do things. And I guess the Monitor Farm program probably really also was another point where you monthly you were up in front of a group of between 50 and 100 people and presenting. And, you know, for the AHDB and for our business, I think that was a really important thing that we did. Worked really well, and it got a good group of local people engaged that maybe hadn't previously been as engaged with each other. So I think that worked really, really well. But also, after your Nuffield, you go around the country giving presentations. And I'd hate to add it up now, but I bet I've probably done 50 or more Nuffield presentations. They're all different, and you always meet people. And, you know, I love meeting people and just chewing the cud, probably with you in the walkabout at 3 in the morning. That's where I think this interview first got around.
I think it was 15
months ago. it's a great opportunity, and I think that all those things have helped just shape my view of the industry, but also give me more confidence to talk about different things that we have to talk about.
Absolutely. So in 2013, you appeared on the TV show Harvest on the BBC. How did that come about?
Yeah, I forgot that during this part of the interview. Good job you've got a list in front of you, isn't it? The Harvest phone call was just so bizarre. So literally mid-Harvest 2012, the phone goes, and so-and-so from the BBC here. And immediately I was a bit taken aback. Yeah. I'd never had that phone call before. Yeah. And they then went on to say, could we come and see you tomorrow? Now, this was mid-harvest. I was driving a combine. And obviously, you say yes, don't you, when the BBC want to come and see you. So they came and saw me. And it was actually a really damp day. So there'd been no rain, I don't think. But we didn't get combining until late afternoon. So luckily, they weren't really, they didn't hold things up. Yeah. But the first thing they said is, we've read your Nuffield paper, and we think there's something slightly different. And this would not have happened without Nuffield, you know. And I had to do a talk last week for Nuffield Farming sponsors. And there are so many doors that Nuffield has opened. And, you know, the BBC Harvest one is one of them. So, you know, they took these sort of mock interviews when they were out doing the Harvest program or doing this pre-recording, because they were going to have to take them back and show their editors and stuff like that. And I mean, I'd love to see those recordings now, because I must have been like a rabbit in the there we were trying to dig up grass and talk about worms and thinking that, that was going to be interesting for the editor to sort of listen to. It all went quiet for about a month. And while they were planning this program, and I probably hounded them a few times, because I was quite excited about, you know, the pitch to me was, you know, this is an opportunity to try and reconnect the public with farming. Yeah. We didn't get paid anything for doing it, and I'd never expect to, but it was just such a great opportunity. And, you know, I think that maybe there was 3 million people who watched it or something like that, but the feedback was just so positive, yeah, from the farming industry about all the range of programs that, yeah, it just, yeah, it hopefully struck a chord and did something useful. But yeah, they came recording for 12 days, and it was the autumn of 2013. Now, that's the autumn of 2012. So, and so for those of you who remember the sort of summer of 2012, it was an absolute shock.
Yes, and I remember it well.
Wind yields were disastrous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And anyway, the autumn was just about, probably even worse. And you know, we were up to our eyeballs in you know, a pretty difficult time. Mm. And actually, the relief on the days when they came recording to, you know, to be able to hand over the keys to a tractor, you know, I'd arrange somebody to do whatever I was supposed to be doing that day. And at 5:30, I'd be out there with the filming crew, and I just handed over the keys. I didn't have to think about farming for a day. And that distraction, it's unbelievable how powerful, you know, it is to just get away and do something different. And I know it's incredibly challenging when you really feel all you've got to do is work. But actually, you know, it's definitely the best medication is to just to try and escape and just do something a bit different. And I had no option because, you know, there were days there where I couldn't do anything else. And it was just say that probably for me is one of the things I really took away from it, was actually that it's important we don't just get tied into our farm 24/7.
Yeah.
But they recorded with us for 12 days over the course of the year, and then they did this as live bit during harvest. Well, and I remember walking into the farmyard. It was up at Duncan Brown's, the gentleman I mentioned earlier on. We did the recording. I walked in there the first day, and there were 20 people in hybrid, and I was just like, what on earth?
I can imagine.
They all loved it. The Duncan family and all his grandchildren were around, yeah, and they, you know, they absolutely loved meeting Greg and Philippa. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm probably less of a fan of Greg's than some people, but you know, I thought for the program itself, he was very uplifting. Mm-hmm. But you know, him and I had a disagreement at one point there when our combine had been sat there for 2 hours and they'd done absolutely nothing with it, Greg turned around and told them he was ruining his career. Why wasn't he doing more? And I did turn around and tell Greg that it wasn't all about him, yeah, and that the combine cost £200 an hour to run, and it was sat there doing diddly squat.
Yeah.
At which point he went and sat in his car for 3 hours.
Okay. you obviously enjoyed it though, because I mean, I watched some of the clips before on YouTube again, and you did come across really well. You're obviously a natural communicator, but you know, you obviously enjoyed talking about your farm and the industry and putting it across to the wider world.
Yeah, I think I said earlier on, Will, that I took my upbringing for granted, yeah, completely. And it was only really during the harvest program that I started to appreciate the environment that we are lucky enough to live in. And, you know, when people are turning up, they've been all over the world, and yeah, everyone's freelance who worked for the BBC or worked on that program, the cameraman, the soundman, and, you know, different people. And so it's, we'd got a couple, you'd got to Philippa and Lucy, who were, and then Lucy was the editor who I got to know really well. But suddenly we were in this valley and we were looking over, and, you know, it was at that moment this cameraman turned around. He just got back from the Arctic, and he was like, wow, this is beautiful, isn't it? And it was probably at that point that I really started, you know, to realize how beautiful our little bit of the countryside is here, and, you know, start to open my eyes to it all. And I think that, I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I think also that's probably one of the reasons I loved it so much looking back now, is that it was just, it was one of those moments where I probably grew up a lot and sort of started to open my eyes a bit more to everything else that was out there. We were lucky to work with a great set of people, and, you know, it's one of those opportunities which I'll probably never have again. But it was amazing to see the industry presented in the way that it was. And I just put so much faith in Lucy, who did the recording, and you know, she, Lucy Smith, I think her name was, and she's now, I know she's now down in Cornwall, running a B&B down there. But I just put so much trust in her. Everyone said, "Did you see a recording before it went on live?" And I was like, "Well, no." "Did you have a right to veto?" And I was like, "Well, no." And they're like, "What did you do?" And I said, "Well, I just trusted the girl," and she genuinely wanted to put agriculture across in its best light. I don't think she's got a bad bone in her body. You know, there was no cynicism. She just wanted to show agriculture to the UK public and you know, sort of give us the best opportunity we could. And I either fell for it hook, line and sinker, or I just, you know, completely trusted her. And anyway, in the end, I was so nervous sat there watching it, but I was delighted with what they put out there. And you know, it's one of those things that hopefully just did the industry a bit of good.
Yeah, it'd be great to see it back again, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Clarkson's like, but I think it'll be a little bit rougher around the edges than that was, and have a bit more, a few more engines involved in it. But you know, with the challenges we're facing at the moment, Will, it's great to have somebody like Clarkson. You know, I mean, people laughed when he said, you know, saving orangutan by oral sea rape, but messages like that are things that, you know, it's difficult for you and I to be saying that, because people don't really believe it's true. But actually, when Jeremy Clarkson says, you know, if we stop growing oilseed rape, then we're going to rely on palm oil and, you know, potentially the destruction of the rainforest, then all of a sudden, you know, the messages are very powerful, and we've got our critics. And so, you know, it'd be really interesting to see how Clarkson gets on, and you know, just exactly what sort of program he delivers. But I don't think it can do us any harm.
No, absolutely. So how did your involvement with the National Farmers Union start?
It's a good question, really. And I was sort of racking my brains as to how it did start. And I guess I went to a few meetings with Dad. I remember going to, well, Emily was up at Harper Adams, so she'd finished her gap year, and I was invited to go to the NFU AGM as a sort of young farmer from the area. And I thought, yeah, well, that'll fit well. I'll go up to Emily's for the weekend, and then I'll go to the NFU AGM. And I walked out of the AGM with a gentleman from Essex, and apparently I said to him, well, that's not for me. And I then didn't go back to the NFU AGM for probably 10 years. And when I did go back, I thought it was a very, very different event. You know, it was, you know, I guess I'd grown up well, and I was ready for it then, whereas when I was 21 ish, 21, 22, it was just, it was a little bit overwhelming, and it was a little bit, politics was something that I wasn't really into at that point in time. But then I started representing Essex on the East Anglian Crops Board, so I was one of the Essex representatives. I think I've done that since about 2009, probably. And I did the culture branch chairmanship probably 2014 to 17, something like that. But while I was on the East Anglian Crops Board, we had the National Crops Board. So every time after the elections for chairman, at that point, we'd end up appointing people to the National Board to sort of try and fill in any skills gaps. And they were advertising for these positions. And my now regional director, Rachel Carrington, turned around and said, I tapped me on the shoulder and said, Tom, have you thought about applying? And I genuinely hadn't really thought about applying, because I thought it was for somebody else rather than me. You know, I just didn't think I was quite up to it. But she said, no, we'd really like to see you apply. And so I applied for that in 2014 and, was successfully interviewed and appointed to the National Board for 2 years. And so I then got a bit of a bug for it, but they changed the rules so that you couldn't become chairman or vice chairman if you were as an appointee.
Okay.
And I understand why they did that, because, you know, effectively, you hadn't been elected to get into that position.
Yeah, okay.
So I then stood for East Anglia Crops Board chair, and, you know, was duly elected as chairman of East Anglia. So that meant I could then stand for an elected position on the National Board. Sure. And my immediately after I'd been elected as East Anglia Board chair, I then stood for vice chairman of the Crops Board in 2016, and I was unsuccessful. And that was a bit of a shock, to be honest with you. And probably one of those learning curves again. That you just probably, as I look back now, it was a valuable lesson, and something that I should have thought more long and hard about. One of the learning curves. And then back in 2018, last year, I stood for chairman. The board thankfully decided that they would give me the opportunity and just to maybe try and take it in a slightly different direction. And you know, it's the commitment that everyone puts into it is, you know, is great. Mike had done 4 years as chairman, and you know, I think that the board probably just felt it was time for a different set of eyes. Mm. So it was, yeah, great to be given the opportunity, and now I suppose just over a year in, and it's, I mean, if you enjoy farm politics, and as I say, if I went back to 15 years ago, I wouldn't have said I did enjoy politics at all. Mm. But now, if you enjoy it and you think you can make a difference, the opportunities and the challenges that are coming our way over the next sort of 2 to 5 years are just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got a fantastic top team in the NFU. Minette's just doing it, playing an absolute blinder at the moment. You know, she's doing a great job. Mm-hmm. And it's all to play for. And, you know, it's great to be involved at what I'm sure we will look back in history as a pivotal time for our industry. And you know, to try and help develop our future at this point in time is just, you know, it's something that I relish the challenge, I enjoy. Mm-hmm. You have to enjoy it because you know, it's a big time commitment with a young family and stuff as well. It's something that I'm just very lucky to be involved
with. Yeah, and what kind of things does your role entail, and what are some of the highlights of the year you've been in charge so far?
I mean, you know, we now know Michael Gove is going to be standing for Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And I guess you may have heard at NFU conference, well, I gave him a bit of a grilling about the tariff schedule that he was proposing, that was going to, that the combinable cropping sector wasn't going to be supported. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I was trying to point out to Michael Gove then is that we are such an integrated industry. Yeah. You know, I think you've got chickens on the farm at home. Well, you need grain to feed your chickens. Mm-hmm. Our biggest customer, as the arable sector, is the white meat sector. And you know, I think that the unintended consequences of the tariff schedule just hadn't been thought through. So, yeah, that's one of those moments in memorable, is, you know, giving him a bit of a grilling there. Mm-hmm. But then, likewise, at the drought summit last year, at the end of the meeting, he turned round and in his summing up said, and as my friend Tom said, and now I'd never profess to be his friend, but you know, it is something that, a highlight that, you know, you would never ever expect somebody that, you know, could be our prime minister in 2 months' time to have said that. Mm. So, you know, they're sort of some of the highlights. I mean, some of the, you know, the difficult conversations, the difficult decisions as well, that we're making, and you know, there are days where, you know, there's one meeting in particular. I won't go into any detail, but you know, I remember, you know, driving back from probably 200 miles the following day, thinking, why the hell do I do this? Mm. You know, it hadn't gone well. It ended up, you know, it just sort of hadn't quite gone to plan. And you just feel at that point that, you know, it can be a pretty lonely place, you know. So it's just, I think that particularly on the arable sector, the challenge we're facing in plant protection products is, you know, we've really refocused our energies on that. And, you know, rather than, you know, looking at we've got to look at the integrated approach to farming far more, and the way we sort of communicate with the public, our messages about how and why we use the products. And, you know, that challenge is something that I'm really relishing sort of having a role in. And, you know, I think that there's no doubt that farming is going to look very different over the next 10 years, but it's just, you know, how we're going to shape that and what the role of these different technologies is going to be.
Yeah. Well, on that then, before we start to finish things off, I did just want to touch on the future a bit. I mean, we've seen such big changes over the last 20 or 30 years in arable farming. What kind of changes do you think we're going to see over the next few decades? And are you excited about all this new technology that's becoming available to growers and its potential for your own business?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. Well, we could probably spend an hour on that, but I think that, am I excited? Absolutely. Mm. Is there going to be challenges? Absolutely. Mm. You know, and will the industry look the same in 10 years' time? I just can't see that it can to be viable. So I think the changes are going to be, you know, very, very large, particularly if we, you know, assuming we carry on and we go through with Brexit, and that we, you know, we then have the removal of the BPS payments. You know, that is going to be seismic changes. Technology, I mean, it's the answer. But I look at the technologies that I've used in our business, and some of them pay back. You know, you can work out the return on investment very quickly. and others I look at, it's far more difficult to work out the return on investment. And so, you know, drones and robots and those sorts of mechanical weeders or robotic weeders, you know, I'm really excited about laser weeders, these robots that can go out and tell the difference between a wheat plant and a blackgrass plant and zap the blackgrass. You know, that is incredibly exciting. You know, how far away is it? 5 to 10 years, I would have thought. What I don't understand is who's going to own that technology. And is it going to help us as farmers be profitable? Because, you know, the critical part of, for our industry is that we have a profitable, thriving industry. And so we can't just afford to keep on pushing money up the chain. We've actually got to capture some of the value at the farm level. Otherwise, you know, it's going to be a real uphill task. And you know, having been lucky enough to travel the world, if we think the UK can be the lowest cost unit producer, I think we've got another thing coming. Yeah. You know, when I look at our big competitors, Ukraine, Russia, South America, North America, they have economies of scale out there that we couldn't dream of. And I think you know, we've got to position ourselves in a slightly different way, because I don't think we should be looking to compete as a lowest cost unit producer. And we've got to be looking for the high value export markets, for those who really, really value provenance and are willing to pay for it. And you know, our Scotch whisky is such a great example of that. But it's things like that that we need to be looking for to make sure we can capture some value. Plant breeding, I think, has got a huge role to play. You know, I'm really, particularly if we can use some of these novel breeding techniques, the CRISPR technologies, they're not GM. There's no foreign DNA going into the plant. It's just simply speeding up natural plant breeding processes in a much more targeted fashion. Now, that could be really exciting for reducing our use of plant protection products. It could be, you know, we could have increased zinc content in wheat, which could help our customers, our consumers. So you know, I think that some of those things are really could be sort of at our fingertips over the next decade sort of or 15 years. But then it's working out how we compete with GM soy, GM corn, and those sorts of imports. So there's a balance to play, but technology is absolutely it's changed the way I farm over the last 10 years, and no doubt it will. I think the changes we'll see over the next 10 or 15 years will be even bigger. And you know, probably it's going to see machinery getting smaller again rather than larger, apart from your combines, and because I think it's inevitable that they will probably stay as big as they are.
Yeah, you currently have a swarm of mini combines, can you? You're not into...
Well, I don't quite see it, but you know what? Somebody will no doubt come up with something somewhere and...
I'm sure. Right, Tom, we will wrap this up in the traditional manner with the 5 hard-hitting questions, if you're ready for them.
We're ready, Will.
All-time favourite song?
Yeah, now, I'm afraid, Will, I've got to just go into another little story here, because it'll just give you an inkling as to how into my music I'm not. So, as part of my Nuffield, I was in Australia, and my flight from... Virgin went on strike, and I was supposed to be flying from Adelaide to Melbourne. That flight got cancelled, so I hired a car in Melbourne and drove right the way through to Brisbane along the Murray River. It was unbelievable. I saw so much, and I met a load of people en route. But my wife joined me on holiday out there after I'd done my Nuffield part, and she said, "Oh, did you have any music on your iPod or on my phone?" I said, "Do you know what? I don't even know, actually." And I looked on my phone, and sure enough, I had no music on my phone. But I'd driven across, I don't know how many miles it is. Is it 2,000 miles, 2,500 miles, something like that, without any music on my phone. So just listening to the radio and watching the world go by and just thinking about, you know, what was going on, really. Yeah. But I like any range of music, Will. I've got Nickelback, This Is How You Remind Me, Kenny Rogers, The Gambler, Johnny Cash, Ring of Fire, Bon Jovi, Living on a Prayer.
Classic.
The Final Countdown, classic rock. You know, anything, really. I could, yeah. But, you know, I love to have a dance. And just something that gets the old feet tapping will
classic.
Yeah, normally get me up and dancing.
Brilliant. All right, then. If you weren't a farmer, what would you do instead?
I'd never expected myself to say this, but I think as I sit here today, I would seriously look at politics.
Yeah, that's really interesting you said that. Yeah. Yeah, you have to throw your hat into the ring.
Well, yeah, I mean, I did see the question you put out asking if any of your other rock and roll farming guests were going to throw their hat in the ring. But no, I mean, it's I think yeah, without going too political, it's been shambolic what we've gone through. And, you know, but it's also got me gripped on the fact, you know, on British politics. Yeah. And,
Okay. You've got access to a time machine for 24 hours only. Where are you going?
You know, I was supposed to think about this answer well, but I haven't. I would have to go forward.
Yeah.
I think I'd probably only want to go 15 years forward, something like that, just to see where we get to in 15 years, because Christ, it would help make policy development a damn sight easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you could put some bets on before you left as well. If the police turned up on the farm and arrested you and took you away without saying anything, what would your family assume that you'd done?
Probably that I'd been streaking.
Streaking.
Yeah, there's been numerous occasions at different points in my life, and notably swimming the cam on my stag do and things like that, that where I may not have worn as many clothes as perhaps I should have done.
It just made me think of that film where what's his name from Anchorman? Okay. Traditional last question, what's your favourite farming social media account?
Yeah, and again, well, this is so difficult because there are just so many out there that they're doing, you know, such a great job. I think, you know, Farmers of the UK, Farmers of the World, they're great. Again, they just give you such an overview of different sort of farming systems, businesses, people, and, you know, that's is great. David Butler's doing a great job at the moment. You know, I think he's really got the bit between his teeth and he's just trying to sort of tackle some of these myths head on, and, you know, he's doing a fantastic job. But look, there are so many great tweeting farmers, and I just hope that our message isn't that we're not speaking to ourselves, and that we can get that message out to the wider audience, because that's what we'd so desperately need to do. Is as farmers, we understand, but we've got to get the message out there to the wider public and our customers about why British food is so great.
Absolutely. Oren, Tom, it's been fantastic. You are a very busy guy, as we've established, so do appreciate you taking the time, and hopefully I'll bump into you somewhere this summer.
Yeah, definitely will, and but great to be involved, and keep on doing the fantastic job that you are.
And we didn't get any interruption from Pippa. She's been good as gold.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah, I'll hand the monitor back over, and that's my job.
All right, cheers, Tom. And everyone at home, thanks for listening, and I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Owens, this has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.